Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is Nicolette St. Lawrence, and I'm the Vice Chairman of the Cornell Republicans. It is my esteemed pleasure to welcome you all to tonight's event, Education in America, What Do We Do Now? Education is an issue that eludes partisan labels. It is a commitment to which we boldly respond in unison, yes. We are all driving toward the same destination, a capable and enlightened next generation of Americans that will advance the legacy of this great nation into the global economy of the 21st century. The only outstanding question remains, how do we get there? What do we do now? Our education system is a complex process that defies simple solutions. A wide-eyed approach to reform is vital, an approach that might bring together a governor, a university chancellor, and a university president to break ground on the topic. While the federal government sputters to a halt, Cornell University continues to drive on toward a solution with tonight's conversation. I invite you all to join me now in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Kyle Lezadine, and I am the chairman of the Cornell Republicans and a senior in the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. Before we begin, I would like to recognize the many campus organizations and departments that came together to produce this event. The American Studies Program, the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs, the Cornell University Program Board, the College of Human Ecology, the Department of Government, the Department of Policy Analysis and Management, WBBR 93.5 Cornell Radio Guild, Alumni Affairs and Development, the Dean of Student Services, and the Division of University Communications. I would also like to give thanks to our advisor, Professor Rosemary Avery, for her support and dedication to the success of this program. And lastly, I would like to extend a very special thank you to the Triad Foundation. This event would not have been possible without their generous support. Before I introduce the host of tonight's conversation, allow me to briefly preview the format of tonight's program. Governor Bush will deliver a keynote address on the state of education in America. The State University of New York Chancellor Nancy Zimfer will then deliver a response, followed by a panel discussion featuring Governor Bush, Chancellor Zimfer, and President Skorton, all of whom are thought leaders on the policy issues facing higher education. There will be a brief audience question and answer period following the panel. Without further ado, it is an honor to introduce the host of tonight's panel, President David Skorton. While all of us are aware of his role here on campus, President Skorton also emerged as a national voice on education-related issues, including college costs, the effects of immigration laws and potential reforms, and the importance of the humanities. During his tenure as president, Cornell substantially increased need-based financial aid, fostered opportunities for undergraduate research and service learning, and implemented new policies to reduce hazing. President Skorton has also served as chair of the Business Higher Education Forum and led the task force on diversifying the New York State economy through industry higher education partnerships. Please join me in welcoming President David Skorton.
Thank you, Kyle, and thank you all for coming to what promises to be an invigorating discussion of education in America as it is today and as it can be in the future. I'm delighted that this discussion today, this week, will feature the former governor of the great state of Florida and the chancellor of the nation's largest university system. For organizing this event, I thank the Cornell Republicans, assisted by major funding from the Triad Foundation and co-sponsorship, as you've heard, by 11 Cornell departments, offices, and programs. We're very honored this evening to have as our keynote speaker Governor Jeb Bush, who has a long and distinguished track record of commitment to improving education. Governor Bush earned a bachelor's degree in Latin American Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin before moving to Florida, where he and a partner founded a real estate development company. He served a term as the state's Secretary of Commerce, and in 1994 ran unsuccessfully for the governorship. He then founded a nonprofit called the Foundation for Florida's Future, whose projects included establishing one of the state's first charter schools. Elected governor of Florida in 1998 and again in 2002, Governor Bush made education reform a major focus of his administration. He sought to raise academic standards, increase accountability in public schools, and offer more school choice. And among other specifics, he endorsed private school vouchers and a requirement for third graders to pass reading tests before being promoted to the fourth grade. Although his voucher programs were partly dismantled by the Florida Supreme Court, students did achieve substantial gains on national reading tests at the fourth grade level. Since his governorship ended in January of 2007, Governor Bush has established a successful consulting business, Jeb Bush & Associates. As chair of the Foundation for Excellence in Education, he is active in urging education reform around this nation. He also co-chairs the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy. Governor Bush is co-author of two books, including the recent Immigration Wars, Forging an American Solution, and as someone involved in the national debate on immigration, I tell you, I'm very much enjoying this book, and I commend it to you. Please join me in welcoming our keynote speaker, Governor Jeb Bush.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you so much. By the way, my guess is that you could probably get Immigration Wars on Amazon on your Kindle at a very deep discount. It was on the bestseller list, number 20, for 1 week. So go out and buy a few. What the hell? Mr. President, thank you for that very kind introduction. Madam Chancellor, it is a joy to be with you. We're going to have a conversation about higher education. You are implementing a lot of really important reforms that in our federal system will likely be stolen by others that are searching for answers of how we can create affordable higher education. To the college Republicans here, I appreciate you. I know that you're the majority of all the student body in Cornell, which warms my heart in so many ways. I thank you for the invitation, and to the Triad Foundation, thank you for allowing this to take place. I'm going to call an audible, I guess, a little bit, and speak about something I'm very passionate about that actually indirectly relates to higher education, and that is, how do we reform our pre-K to 12 system so that higher ed kind of naturally takes its place and can reform itself more organically rather than having to deal with an incredible challenge for the greatest country on the face of the earth, which is that half of the kids that go to community colleges in our country need remedial work. They have to take math or language arts, high school math or language arts over again to begin to pursue a higher education. Half. And in our four-year degree program, four-year universities, not Cornell, of course, but many of the four-year universities, that number is increasing to more than 25%. In fact, a third of our kids, if you take the ACT test, which is one of the exit tests to determine whether you're college ready, 25% of the students that take that test pass all of the four elements of that test that means that they are ready to go to college or equally important, can pursue a career. So my idea for higher ed reform is to radically transform how we educate kids at the earlier grades. And my guess is that the fretting and hand-wringing and worrying about how higher ed is doing in the world and all the analysis would begin to subside pretty quickly. So I want to start with a question for you all. A child enters kindergarten. His mother is a single parent that might work minimum wage. Or perhaps he lives in the inner city and is an immigrant learning English. What do we expect of him? Do we expect them to read by third grade? Do we expect him to learn fractions, to write coherent sentences, to graduate from high school, equipped to attend college, to begin a career or join the armed forces? Or as a society, do we look at his circumstances, dumb down his expectations and our expectations of him, and give his school an excuse not to make every effort to ensure that he learns? Do we just shuffle him through the system, promote him out of third grade, into fourth grade, even if he can't read? Let the fourth grade teacher deal with it, who in turn will let the fifth grade teacher deal with it, and so on, until he's so far behind that no one deals with it and that child drops out of school. Perhaps we sanction this under the guise of self-esteem and compassion because it sounds right, and frankly, it relieves adults of their responsibilities but not their paychecks. So seriously, what would you do? Would you expect more of this young boy or less? That is really the question, the defining question that we must have as a nation if we're serious about assuring that young people have the right to rise, that there is a restoration of economic and social mobility. If the answer to this is that you believe in higher expectations, then you're an education reformer, whether you like it or not. The simple fact is education reform has one guiding principle, and it is that every child can learn. Reformers refuse to accept the excuses that only set children up for failure and deny them the opportunity to achieve the American dream. To me, this is immoral on an individual level and certainly unsustainable on a national level if we plan to be world leaders as we emerge into the 21st century. Those vested in the status quo in public education never stop fighting against change, and that's hardly surprising. We're taking on a $600 billion enterprise with more than 6 million employees. The idyllic notion of the old one-room schoolhouse has been turned into a government jobs program where the number of employees has grown at 4 times the rate of the number of students. Empires do not go quietly into the night. But reform is maturing into a broad-based, bipartisan movement, and so now joining conservatives on the target list of those that defend the status quo are a group of courageous center-left Democrats, particularly in the big urban areas of our country. In fact, I invited Rahm Emanuel to our annual summit this last year because I thought the unions would, you know, said some of the most nastiest things I've ever heard about me until I heard what they said about Rahm Emanuel. That gave him an immediate invitation, which he accepted. Which he accepted and described the reforms that he is embarking on in Chicago with great challenges for sure, and it's slow progress, but he is committed to education reform, and so are many other big urban Democratic mayors. They're not those that are there to protect the corporate interests. They're certainly not conservatives. All of the dialogue that goes against those that believe in reform, you cannot put Rahm Emanuel, you cannot put his face on the screen with the attacks. But in fact, that coalition is emerging, and it is important for us to make this a bipartisan movement to assure that every child can learn. Reform is not necessarily ideological, but certainly there should be a degree of impatience about all this. My God, I mean, the results that we have demand that we are more impatient. Because at the end of the day, we have a glut of schools that parents don't want and a dire shortage of those that they would choose if they had the right to do so. And is it any wonder? For decades, our most vulnerable kids have fallen through the cracks and under the radar with nary a word of protest from those who can't complain enough about the attempt now to try to stop the system that we have. Half of our Hispanic and African American fourth graders are functionally illiterate. Half. This great country cannot tolerate that, in my mind. If you're a compassionate person, you know the outcome of that. You know what the outcome is, and yet we accept it as though it's something that, as a society, we can't turn around. They're 2.5 years behind their white student counterparts. Walk into a first grade classroom in Florida, Texas, California, or New York, and look at the faces, and tell me how much time we have to turn this around. And the problem is bigger than that. Only a quarter, as I said, of the students taking the ACT this year qualified as college ready on all 4 sections. Half of the students entering community colleges require remediation. 1/3 of the high school graduates fail the military entrance exam. Our students' performance on international assessments in reading and math and science can best be summed up as mediocre. We worry a lot about our children's self-esteem. In Asia, they worry about whether their kids have a deep understanding of algebra and science. Which part of the world will be the winners going forward with that kind of attitude? You know, there's no magic formula for making kids smarter. Instead, we must rely on a variety of reforms which in concert can produce strong gains. I have six suggestions. First, we should begin with early literacy. I do not understand the logic of promoting illiterate children in third grade to fourth grade when we ask them to begin to not just learn how to read, but read so that they can learn. It makes no sense to me. It falls under the category in my mind of who do we think we're kidding? They can't read the assignments, they can't do the homework, they can't prepare reports or pass the tests. And as a result, they are four times more likely to drop out. 85% of the kids who enter the juvenile justice system are functionally illiterate. 70% of prison inmates can't read above the fourth grade level. Illiteracy destroys lives, and nothing focuses schools on early childhood literacy than retention policies backed by strong intervention policies and well-trained teachers. In Florida, we put reading coaches in every elementary school to teach teachers how to teach reading, because believe it or not, that is not one of the things that they naturally get in the schools of education. We have the greatest participation in early childhood. Here's a conservative that believes that if you can empower young people at the youngest ages, you can achieve great things. 70% of all fourth graders attend some form of a literacy-based pre-K program. We put a gate from third grade to fourth grade, and the whole system then began to focus on how do we make this happen? How do we assure that kids aren't functionally illiterate? So first grade teachers were part of the strategy, and second grade teachers were as well. No one waited to the third grade and said, oh, poor little Juanito, no se puede, and then leave him cast aside so that he eventually drops out. And because of that, we cut in half the functional illiteracy rate in a matter of 2 years. You can move the needle if you have a gateway that is serious. Next is school choice. We have the most diverse student population in history. It defies common sense, again, to corral them all in the same early 20th century, education model and expect them to thrive. It makes less sense when their neighborhood schools have had a long track record of failure. Bureaucracies are not designed, Mr. President, ILR, is that what it's called, IRL, ILR? I'm sure in your studies, when you study government-driven bureaucracies, your professors hopefully will tell you this, they're not designed to innovate. They don't like competition. They don't like accountability. What they do like are no surprises and secure jobs. And so we have an education system that is woefully behind the times. It has been isolated from the very forces that have driven American innovation and success for more than two centuries. There should be more options for parents, particularly parents that otherwise wouldn't have options because of the level of their family income. We should have more charter schools. We should have more homeschool opportunities, more vouchers, more tax credits, more education savings accounts, more course credits, which exist, for example, in Louisiana, more virtual school opportunities. We should have a menu for parents to empower them to make decisions that are best for the diverse needs of the next generation. And allowing them to shop for their best choice for their students creates better schools across the board. When Florida opened up its system, as we have done, and a few other states have done the same, all schools got better because parents were engaged and made choices, and the bureaucracies around the traditional public schools, while reluctant, didn't like this, trust me, there wasn't a lot of celebrating with the Bush plan in this regard and inside of our traditional schools, but they responded, and they responded with a higher quality product, and many parents benefited from that did not take the private or other public options. Digital learning needs to be a third part of this. I don't know what you guys think, but ever since that guy invented the internet, it seems like there's a lot of new opportunities in a lot of different areas of life. My kids and I got a two-year-old kid, Georgia Helena Walker Bush. She is a complete digital native. And anybody at that age that begins to access technology, just as our children and grandchildren do, we'll have a world of opportunity if we begin to organize our schools around this very incredible opportunity. Kids come home from school today, they put their backpacks which weigh at least 25, some of them 50 pounds, you know, throw them on the floor. They pick up their iPads or some other device, they tap on an app, and off they go into the digital realm. It's like Bam Bam from the Flintstones turns into Elroy Jetson. We need to make education relevant for 21st century kids, and that means communicating with them on their terms as digital natives. And it will prepare them for college, where increasingly students are taking digital courses on campus and digital courses off campus to be able to get a quality education. A math whiz can take 6 months to get Algebra 2 done, while others might take 11 months. But the simple fact is that kid that struggled will have the tools to be able to succeed rather than pass along without understanding it. And the kid that can do it in 6 months can move on to the next subject matter rather than waiting for the 180 days to finish with their little butts in a seat as the organizing principle of how we educate. 45% of college students now take online courses. Madam Chancellor, my guess, based on what you all are trying to embark on, it'll be 100% pretty quick throughout the United States. Shouldn't we prepare high school graduates for what is coming? But in most states, there are massive protectionist laws in the K-12 system that retard the advancement of digital learning because this is a huge threat. Think about yourself as a collective bargaining leader for government employees in school districts. How do you organize for the kid or the Microsoft engineer building a really cool algebra course that can be shared with teachers in any state? How do you collectively bargain for that content? It is much easier to bargain in the old industrial model, but the digital model will empower students far more than the one that has existed for the last 100 years, and we must change the governance if we're going to be successful in customizing the learning experience. The fourth suggestion is robust accountability matters in child rearing, it matters in business, it matters in every aspect of our life. If you don't measure, you don't care. If you have no consequence between failure and excellence, you'll get less excellence. If there's no support for improvement, you'll get mediocrity. Sound familiar? That's the way we live our lives. But yet, schools do not generally have that kind of accountability. There's no transparency. There's very little assessment done in a way that can help remediate the problems before the end of the year. And there's no consequence in many places of this country, sadly, for the abject failure that takes place. I think we need to make sure that every child goes to a high-quality school. In order to do that, you need to have robust accountability. In Florida, we did something really radical. Florida's not really a radical place, but this apparently was a radical idea. We graded schools A, B, C, D, and F, 100% based on student learning, half on learning gains and half on how students did to the standards. It gave parents a real clear snapshot about where their children were and where their schools were, and it also created massive improvement. That transparency should be encouraged and not feared. States can drive remarkable results with robust accountability measures. Ask Joel Klein, chancellor, former chancellor of the school district, the largest school district in the United States, New York City. When they began to grade schools, parent participation improved, school grades improved because student learning improved. And New York went from the bottom of the pile in New York State to one of the reasons why New York has had learning gains, as its largest school district did all sorts of reforms, but at the core of this was a focused approach on accountability. And the simple result is, in Florida, we literally went from the bottom of the pack, allowing some, not me, I promise. I have a few Florida friends here, so this is not what I heard from others. Which, you know, we were 29th out of 31 on the NAEP test, for example, for fourth grade reading in 1997, and some would say, you know, thank God for Louisiana and Mississippi. Not me. And in fact, I would argue that if you look at what Mississippi and Louisiana are doing today, they have rising student achievement because they've embraced broad-based reform, and they're now going to be a model that others will begin to emulate. And African-American kids in those two states are going to see learning gains that will be the envy of places like New York. So I'm not making fun of Louisiana or Mississippi, but that's what people whispered. We went from 29th out of 31 in a 10-year period to 6th out of 50 on the nation's report card because we imposed these accountability measures. We need to upgrade the teaching profession. Great teachers matter a lot. In fact, there's a lot of research now that suggests that a child in a classroom of a great teacher gets a year and a half worth of learning in that year's time. And sadly, a student in a classroom of an ineffective teacher, on the other hand, gets a half a year's learning in a year's time. So imagine being in a class where you have an extraordinary teacher for 2 years in a row. You're excelling, you're soaring. The options that you feel and sense that you have begin to expand exponentially. And then imagine the children that are traditionally in the lower performing schools in our country that get a half a year's knowledge in a half a year's time. They're 2 years behind in 2 years' time, and those gaps are very hard to overcome. Don't let anybody tell you that all teachers are great, and don't let everybody tell you that all teachers are bad. In fact, there's a bell curve just like there is in everything else. And the strategy ought to be that we reward the very best to keep them in the classroom, pay them a lot, reward them with additional responsibilities. For those in the middle, we need to create strategies that are to remediate the challenges of the classroom so that they can get better. And that those are at the bottom that are chronically bad, my humble suggestion is that they ought to be fired. There should be no way that we keep tenured teachers that cannot teach. The simple fact is those teachers are protected. They're protected all sorts of different ways, and the end result is that children that are in those classrooms suffer enormously. Now that is the way, that's a union-friendly model. As I said, that's a great way to collectively bargain to protect teachers, but it's not a student-centered model. And for us to be successful in the 21st century, I think we need to put students first. It will happen if we eliminate tenure and evaluate and pay teachers based on performance in a thoughtful way and pay them a lot more for a job well done because of the power that they bring. I would add that the schools of education in our university system need to be evaluated inside, outside, upside down, every possible way because they're not cutting it. Teachers are coming into classrooms unprepared. Alternative certification is another means by which great teachers can emerge. There is no set way of getting a great teacher in the classroom, but when they're there, we should be able to take care of them to make sure that they stay. Lastly, high standards matters. It is the most basic element of reform. Standards define what children are expected to learn over the school year, and they need to know what they need to know to prepare for success in each grade. Ultimately, the quality of standards determines whether a high school diploma is worth more than the paper that it is printed on. With a third of our kids graduating from high school, college, and or career ready, a third graduate with a piece of paper, but it's not worth anything because they can't get a job, and they certainly can't go to a community college or a four-year university without taking remedial courses. And a third, sadly, more or less, drop out. To compete with the world in the 21st century, we must produce competitively high school graduates that are competitive and ready for college or meaningful careers, which means that we need to raise the bar, not lower the bar. We need to have standards that are benchmarked to the best in the world. We need to ask university presidents what their expectations are for entering freshmen and place our standards for 12th graders at that level. We need to ask employers in our communities, what are your expectations for someone to be able to have a job of meaning and purpose? What are your expectations for the high school? And set our expectations that at that level. The good news is Common Core State Standards is the first effort of its kind to do just that. Believe it or not, if you can imagine in this kind of crazy political environment, 45 states about 6 years ago came together through the NGA and through the state school officers group, the state boards of education, to create a set of standards that most people believe are benchmarked to the best in the world, and they're common. And the fact that they're common, I believe, will create a renaissance in new quality, higher quality content so that we can assure that more children learn. The simple fact is there's massive retaliation going on right now. I don't know if you see the tire marks on my forehead because of this subject, but the simple fact is for those that have legitimate concerns or illegitimate ones for that matter as it relates to Common Core State Standards and its implementation, I would ask you, defend the dumbed down gobbledygook that we have now. If you can defend that, then I will respect your view, but don't try to tear down an effort that actually will improve standards and raise expectations and move the entire system up so that every high school graduate that graduates can go to a community college or a four-year degree university, taking freshman courses, or even higher than that. That should be our aspiration as a nation, as it is for every country that is aspiring to greatness in the world. Let me close with this. Yeah, three cheers for Common Core State Standards. I like to hear that. Let me close with this. There was a beloved pediatric surgeon in Orlando named Dr. Ronald Davin. Diagnosed with terminal cancer, he spent his last years in the operating room restoring the most fragile of lives. When asked why he was so passionate about his job, he had this simple response. I like the duration of the cure. Saving a young life produces a lifetime of learning. Think of the untapped potential in our country. Think of the problems we whine a lot about these days. I mean, it's like the most pessimistic group of Americans in American history in so many ways. Look at it on a positive basis. Think about the untapped potential, the human potential of young people that don't have the power of knowledge yet, but could. We're talking about billions, trillions of dollars of increased economic activity. We're talking about the cultural divide that exists right now that is tearing our country asunder, and the income inequalities that exist begin to narrow. We're talking, in my mind, if we had this as a great American challenge, if we did, to consider each one of these trials the duration of the cure, if we made this a national imperative, much of the political debate would change. It would change dramatically in my mind. We would begin to rebuild the center, and we would focus on consensus and compromise to move forward rather than arguing past each other. This should be a national calling. Think of all the young people that right now are not getting a quality education and how their lives will look 10 years from now. Now, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, that should be something of importance. And if you can argue that the status quo will deliver more of those young people to the finish line of being success, having success to enter college or to gain a meaningful job, then go at it. I've not found someone who can make a compelling case more of the same works. I do believe that if we transform our education system, many more young people will gain the power of knowledge and will renew and rebuild our country. Thank you all very much.
Please, one more time, I want to recognize that very thought-provoking talk. Thank you, Governor. Okay, boys and girls, we're just getting started. Now, here to share her thoughts on these very important issues is another nationally known voice for education and a treasured colleague, Chancellor Nancy L. Zimfer of the State University of New York, of which Cornell University is very proud to be associated. Throughout her adult life, Chancellor Zimfer has been attuned to the value of education and how to make educational systems effective. She has a bachelor's degree in English education and speech, a master's in English literature, and a PhD in teacher education and higher education administration, all from The Ohio State University. She became chancellor of SUNY in 2009 after serving as president of the University of Cincinnati, and before that, chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. As SUNY's chancellor, she leads the largest system of higher education in this nation with 64 campuses and nearly 500,000 students. She has worked to strengthen both the individual campuses and the system itself, coordinating efforts for greater efficiency across this vast network. In her first year as chancellor, she immediately led the creation of a new strategic plan, The Power of SUNY, emphasizing the potential of SUNY institutions as drivers of economic development. When she was hired as chancellor, the chair of SUNY's Board of Trustees, Carl Hayden, described her as having the uncommon ability to be collaborative and decisive at the same time. Subsequent years have proved him right, as Dr. Zimfer has effectively led the SUNY system through some very challenging times. I'm looking forward to hearing her thoughts. Please welcome SUNY Chancellor Nancy Zimfer.
again.
Well, thank you so much, and good evening, everybody. I'm really thrilled to be here. I thank President David Skorton for inviting me, as well as the sponsors who have made this evening possible. And I'm thrilled to share the podium with Governor Bush. I have had the privilege of hearing Jeb Bush speak on many occasions. I am so impressed with how you have become an absolute student and practitioner of education, and there's really nothing that you have said that I've not been familiar with in the literature of educational reform. So I think it's very impressive, and I'm thrilled to get into the dialogue with you. David has kindly invited me to take a few minutes, so let me again thank our sponsors, thank you as participants, and tell you that this evening there are two trustees of the State University of New York Board of Trustees with us tonight. One is Professor Ron Ehrenberg, whom many of you know. That's free, Ron. That is really good. And we are also here with Trustee Hank DeLay. So I'm very pleased to be here. Trustee DeLay. I was thinking about how to organize my thoughts, and the first thing I would say, Governor, and we've talked about a national strategy for educational reform, we don't really have a system of education in this country. And I think that might sound a little unfamiliar, but the fact of the matter is we legislate elementary and secondary education over here. Was called No Child Left Behind, now called Race to the Top, but it's the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And over here, we legislate the Higher Education Act. It usually takes us 6 or 7 years to get that through the Congress. But they are two bodies of work and policy that don't statutorily connect. And you find as well that in early childhood education and for children and the protection of children, there is statutory and legislative action that occurs in HHS, in education, in the Department of Labor. And then if you go to the other end of the continuum, career education, it's happening in the Department of Labor, Department of Education. So I don't quite see how we're ever going to get our act together unless we find more collaborative ways to legislate and set policy at the federal level. You will find that same disconnect in states where departments of education tend to regulate elementary and secondary, and commissioners and systems of higher education, the higher education. Now, in New York, I feel compelled to say that many of the reforms in Florida appear to be happening right here in New York. Governor Cuomo has an education reform commission. We're doing early childhood, extended day, the Common Core. We're a great champion, governor of the Common Core, teacher evaluation, higher admission standards for teacher education, master teachers, community schools. So we are on target with these reforms. But as a university, and really what I was asked to talk a little bit about, is what is our posture on educational reform? So, oddly enough, the only thing I might take issue with, Governor Bush, is this. For far too long, our colleagues in higher education have sort of let it be said, if you would just send us better students, we would do a better job. And at least for the State University of New York, that is an unacceptable posture. And I often say, we prepare the teachers who teach the kids who come to college, ready or not. We have to own this problem. That said, the formula we're operating under at the State University of New York is kind of simple. A plus C equals S. We feel a responsibility to access. We have always been a high access institution, but unless we're willing to partner up with our early childhood, elementary, and secondary partners and really see those evidence-based interventions occur through our teachers in those classrooms, we're going to get what we've always gotten, which is a very high degree of remediation. Way too high, unacceptable, teaching twice. So access is a driver for us, and across this state, we have a number of these cradle-to-career partnerships where we gather communities around evidence-based interventions to make sure that kids come to kindergarten ready to learn, our fourth grade literate, eighth grade mathematical, enter high school, ready for college, go on to college, and matriculate through college and career. We're also increasingly more committed to completion. I think this country got access long before they figured out that it had to be tethered to completion. Completion means affordability. Completion means accountability. It means more courses delivered in a timely fashion. It means bringing down the indebtedness of our students. It means fully disclosing the cost of college so that students know how to maneuver the financial pitfalls that happen to so many students who accrue so much debt. And this is where online enabled learning can help us as well. SUNY is about to launch in January a thing called Open SUNY, where in the next 3 years we will invite over 100,000 new students to join SUNY through online enabled instruction. We'll have more completion, we'll have more job readiness, because we can blend the residential experience with the online experience and create more opportunity for our students. So you might have been familiar with access, you're certainly familiar with our commitment to completion, but let me unpack equals success. I heard it in President Scorton's remarks. We are very much committed to applied experiential learning opportunities for our students. We define this typically as service learning, often as paid internships, but we are taking it that further step to a thing nationally called cooperative education, where students are placed in highly supervised, paid, product-driven, degree-worthy work experiences in any number of applied fields while they're in college, either residentially or online. We know that if a student has a bona fide supervised, paid, and repetitive online or work experience, rather, whether it's when you're taking an online course or a residential degree program, you have a 90% chance of being offered a job by one of those prospective employers. So access is about dipping down and working with our early childhood and K-12 partners. Completion is about bringing down the cost of college and ensuring that students have access to the courses they need in a timely fashion. And success is about giving our students the career opportunities they deserve while they're in college, so that completion really can result in a career. The thing I like best about something David Leonhardt said is that our mission is driven in this way: educating people, educating more people, and educating them better is simply the best bet any society can make. Thank you.
Stage right, and it doesn't really matter. Well, here's where we're going to have some conversation between our two distinguished speakers, and we're going to do that, give or take, for about 15 minutes or so, and they're going to open up to you and some folks who have sent some questions in from outside. So I'm going to kick it off, do a little tip of the ball, and then we'll sort of see where we go. A couple of years ago in this country, we finally hit the point where 30% of the adult population had been to college. It's an important statistic for us to remember here in the cocoon of a higher education institution that most of the adults in the country have not been to college. Now here we are at the second decade of the 21st century, and the question I am asked the most when I'm out speaking with people who are not actually immediately part of the Cornell world but have strong feelings about education, and as the chancellor said, and as the governor said, all of education, not just higher education, is, does everybody need to go to college? Now, we interact with populations who apply, who all want to go to college. Governor, last year we got 40,000 applicants for 3,282 slots here at Cornell. These are odds, in case you're interested. If I had had to go through them, I'd still be at my old man's shoe store, which was all right in its own way. But the question, the first question for our distinguished guests is, does everyone in the country who completes secondary school need a college education? And if so, what sort of a college education? And I'd like to start out with the governor.
The answer, I think, is no. I don't think everybody should go to college, but everybody should have the right to go to college. They shouldn't be tracked at an early stage where they track to a dead end. And the interesting thing is, as I've gotten immersed in these, I never thought I would actually read detailed works on standards. It's like, geez, it's like a root canal to try to read this stuff. But the effort underway is to try to not create a dual track, you know, for college-bound kids and then kids that can get a high school degree, but all bets are off after that. Is to have similar standards, the same standards, so that young people can make choices at the appropriate time, not in middle school, but in high school. And there should be many more career-oriented opportunities. There are a lot of states now that are really focusing on this. So the effort is to be college-ready, but career-oriented. And there's a ton of, if you look at the economy particularly, this will ebb and flow based on demand, right? If you look at the economy, there are 3 million skilled jobs right now unfilled in the biggest downturn since the 1930s. It's been consistent, 3 million skilled jobs unfilled because we don't have people that have the skills to take them on. And not all of them, in fact, I would say a majority of those don't require a four-year degree or a post-secondary degree or postgraduate degree. They require skills. And so I would say community colleges can play a role in this. Certainly our high schools can play a role in this. But I really worry about this idea. I think we've maybe gone overboard to say every kid's going to go to college. That's fine. And I hear politicians say that as kind of the aspiration. But on the other hand, I would worry about going to a model that looks more like Europe, where you're tracked and you basically your destiny is defined way too early. That's not the American way. We don't have to steal every great idea from the rest of the world. We may want to look at our own set of values and apply some of those to find the best solutions.
Thank you, Governor. Now, thinking about the broad spectrum of higher education opportunities, you cover them all in the SUNY system, and because of your formal and work background, I think that you are really uniquely qualified to answer the same question. And then one more question beyond that, if you would. The first one being, does everybody need to go on to college after finishing a secondary degree? And the second is, for those who do, how do you decide what they should be aiming at? Community college, some other sort of institution? You're in charge of the whole spectrum. So both questions, please.
Well, it's, I have to remember both questions. There's a lot of pressure. I kind of want to say everybody deserves a right to be smart. And I think when we start trying to decide who gets vocational or who gets career skill-based and who goes to college, we must be talking about somebody else's kids. Where do you want your kids to go? What do you want your kids to do? So being smart is exactly what the Common Core was about. It's supposed to be a backtracking for what prepares you to be successful in college. Backtrack to secondary, middle school, elementary school. I think that's a pretty good idea. It means that you're going to be able to do your numbers. It means that you're going to be literate. It means that you're going to be a good problem solver. Whatever your career, or as we are told, multiple careers over the course of a lifetime. So one of the things that's happening now is that increasingly universities are working with high schools. In New York, we call it early college high schools. We just launched 16 more, in fact, I think we'll be celebrating tomorrow this pathways to a technical early college high school experience in New York, which means in high school, people are going to see the array of careers and also have employers committed to take a high school graduate into a corporation if that's what the student wants. So our students come on to community college knowing they can either do a skill, get a certificate or a two-year degree, or they can be prepared to transfer on to college. And by and large, the student is the driver at that point. What we do is offer opportunity, and I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think we want to track. I don't think we want to decide for. And I certainly don't think that we want to assume that low-income students, and that's the danger, who are disproportionately ethnically and racially diverse, are somehow going to take a pathway other than the be smart, go to college, and get a job pathway. Okay, what was the second question?
That's okay. You covered it very, very well. You know, I was hoping for some fireworks or whatever, but that's, you guys are both being very reasonable and agreeing on the big principles. So if you insist on communicating well, fine. Have it your way. All right, let's take this to the next level. Let's assume that we're talking about the population of students who do choose to go to college and are prepared to do so. In the 40 years or so that I've been in this business, I've seen sort of counter-cyclical with the economy changes in the answer to this question: what is a college education for? Tougher the economy, the more we tend to focus on vocational type things, very understandable, it's hugely understandable. And then we back off a little bit when things are a little bit better and talk about the importance of a broad liberal education. I think we're getting close to a sort of a crisis point in the country. Perhaps crisis is a strong word. But if this online education revolution, which you're doing so much to foster at SUNY, Chancellor, really becomes as facile as we think it might, the country is pretty soon going to come to a point of deciding to endorse competency-based education, in which, by whatever mechanism people like the Chancellor dream up, will get somebody to the point of having a particular skill set as soon as he or she is ready. It might or might not require a residency of a certain length of time, so on and so forth. That will increase the pressure on thinking about education toward a certain vocational goal. And because of what you both have alluded to, that we're going to go through multiple jobs and even careers during our lifetimes, how should we design a college experience? Should we predominantly base it on what the young person is thinking he or she wants to do at the time of matriculation? Should we think about that and sort of listen to it halfway and say, well, we know a little bit better and you need to have some breadth to the education? How can we design that experience? I'd like to start this time with you.
Well, you know, everything is sort of dichotomized as you're going to take this position or that position. There's at least one book title that's about the tyranny of the or. So it's neither one or the other. But I think we are a little bit conflicted because on the one hand, business and industry is telling us that skills matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for all practical purposes, we're in this competency-based world. Mm-hmm. The Western Governors University is totally, exclusively online competency-based. Mm-hmm. But business and industry, and I don't want to exclude the nonprofits that employ a lot of our graduates as well, they also want critical thinkers, problem solvers, people who can work in teams, people who can drive towards solutions. So what we really need is an educational experience that through whatever vehicle, online or on campus, or what I think it's really going to be is a mix of the two, where people, young people, adults who are educated, learn how to use disciplines to learn how to think, to learn how to solve problems. You might be a historian, you might be a literature major, you might be an engineer, but you do have to learn all those what are mistakenly identified as soft skills. I think they're really hard skills. I just think we're not quite sure how to inculcate them into learners. So I think the problem of what career choices students make will ultimately take care of themselves, but we as an academic institution, I hope we'll always retain the liberal education that the general education provides and the skills and the experiential learning opportunities that make a fully educated person. And I'm trying to think how the governor and I can disagree about that.
I think we might. So I gave the commencement address at the Western Governors University. It was an online commencement address. It was pretty cool. I Skyped it in, I think. There were 2,000 people in an auditorium in Atlanta at the Western Governors University. And there were 8,000 people, apparently, that were on their computers watching this. And the three students that graduated, none of them were 23 years old, that spoke. There were 5,000 graduates this semester. The three that spoke, none of them were 23 years old. None of them were this, you know, kind of idyllic notion of a Cornell graduate, you know, that you go to school right out of high school, you come here, you graduate in 4 years, and off you go. There was a girl who got pregnant when she was 16 years old. She was the smartest kid in her family. She was isolated and marginalized. She dropped out of school, went to work, had a baby, lived at home, went to work for 10 years to be able to save up enough money and have her child be old enough for her to begin to get a GED and then begin her journey in college. And she was there after 10 years with an HR degree, and she announced in front of this crowd, after achieving this incredible effort, competency-based, the sacrifice that this young woman made, and now at the age of 35 or 36, and she announced that she was going to get an MBA at Western Governors University. That's the challenge for higher education, is that the traditional student, except in the elite universities, is very different today than it was. And I think the competency-based model, it doesn't have to be the only model for sure, but it is a fantastic model, and the focus ought to be on lifelong learning, it seems to me. And so here's why is that important? I think I know the statistics at the SUNY system a little better than Florida's, but not much. Florida measures full-time students. Full-time students are 12 credit hours now, which that's odd in Florida. 12 credit hours as a full-time student. They measure four-year degree completions as the percentage of kids that graduate with a four-year degree in 6 years. 60% in the United States, about 60% of full-time students graduate with a degree in 6 years. And the number one degree program, I don't know what it is here, the number one degree program in Florida is psychology. It's not reality-based. The system is not... It's not driven, there has to be more, and this is where maybe we'll have a disagreement. I think there has to be a recognition. The world has radically changed, and our universities are struggling with this now. This change is kind of cascaded in their lives, and I think they have to start making adjustments, and competency-based learning is a good example of how that would apply.
I want to say, David, that President Obama was here not too long ago, and he was announcing his accountability, affordability, innovation agenda, and the idea that higher education is going to have a scorecard. And of course, we're all talking about who's going to get to decide what the metrics are that are going to be measured. But I just wanted to react that the federal data system is incredibly flawed. I think I can get support from Professor Ehrenberg on this point. We have no idea what the graduation rate is in America. Because we only look at full-time, first-time freshmen, and we give them 6 years to dawdle on through the curriculum. But in fact, people are getting degrees and completing at a much higher rate. Our community college students leave community college in the first year. They don't stay for the second year. They don't stay for the associate degree. They go on, and they're very successful in a four-year baccalaureate program. We have no idea how to track that. So I do think that...
You ought to.
We ought to, I mean, we want to, but we don't have a data system, and we also don't exactly agree on something like a unit record. There we could probably get into a little tussle on that because of privacy issues, et cetera, but we don't have a way of tracking the accomplishments of our students, and we have to figure that out, just like healthcare is trying to figure out what the personal record,
Don't hire the contractor, please. You set yourself.
But you can go to your doctor and have a cumulative record of your healthcare services, and we need to figure that out for education so that we understand more about how students learn and acquire a degree.
Now this leads terrifically into another question, and I'm I'm trying hard to get some emotion into this here, and you guys are being just enormously well-behaved and whatever, I don't know. Makes you proud to be an American. But anyhow, well, it's nice.
You got a low bar to define pride in America.
Yeah, anyway, we'll just let that go by. This discussion you just had about we ought to find a way and things are so decentralized and so on, the whole education world in the United States is very decentralized, right? Every aspect of it. The K-12 system is paid for locally, governed locally. We could talk all day long. I happen to be very much in favor of the Common Core standards, support them through an organization called the Business Higher Education Forum that both of us are active in. And I'm in a profession where you wouldn't want your physician taking care of you if she or he hadn't passed a standardized test, a board exam. Even then, you might not want me taking care of you after all this time. But the fact is, we defend, in this country, the United States, we defend the local right to take care and do things the way we want. And universities, sort of a liberal part of the political spectrum, are just the same. Now, you're the chief of a system, and yet I'm sure when you have your president's meetings, everybody has their own idea. We have one single university here with 14 colleges and schools, count them, 14. Mm-hmm. And we believe that the semi-autonomy of those schools has led over 149 years to enormous excellence. So I sort of think you can't have it both ways. Do we need to develop some sort of central control of education from P to graduate school, whether it's through standardized tests, whether it's through standardized checking of the way curricula are made, something like that? Or should we allow the system to develop any which way it wants to and then test the product of the system at the other end? Governor?
I vote for the latter in the sense that I think there ought to be higher expectations, they ought to be clear, and they can be national. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, this is something of national purpose, national meaning. We should have as a country, this is a moonshot to me. So I think it's fine to have as a goal, as an aspiration, a meaningful, I'm not kidding, not a vague, a real aspiration about what expectations are for young people, pre-K to 20. I believe that's fine. How we achieve that, let's let 1,000 flowers bloom. And I would argue that means that we throw off some of the antiquated systems that have governed higher education, and for that matter, K-12 for a long while. Accreditation. Is it really this will get everybody mad probably, but I mean, do we have to count all the number of library books one more time when the accreditation committee comes in? Is there another way that's more, say, the librarian gets all upset? that crazy thing called the internet. I don't know, maybe there's another opportunity that relates to learning. I think the old systems make it harder to adapt and change in the way that universities want to do it. Cornell is different. And I think its greatness is in its differentiation. It's probably the only university of its kind like it. You couldn't compare it to any other kind of university. I think that's good. But higher expectations is something I think we should have. It doesn't have to be national like federal, but it can be national like a goal, like Americans saying, this is what we expect.
Darn, I was trying to get you to go for that federal thing, but you wouldn't do it.
No, I'm not biting on that.
I tried.
I have nightmares of implementation of website, sites. It's just, I just don't see that as the place where innovation's gonna run wild.
I want to reassure you about one thing. Tomorrow I'm giving my State of the University address. It will be on our website. You can get to it. I'm sure that's what you were talking about.
You probably have 20 million people trying to get on, though. You better be careful.
Actually, we have 22,000 students trying to stay away from my speech tomorrow. Any comments on this issue?
Yeah, I have a comment.
Please.
I totally agree that a national vision is critically important. And for better or worse, we've got one right now. It's about completion. It's not only articulated by the administration, but every organization in the country has set a 2015, 2020, 25, Gates, Lumina, the Governors Association. Everybody wants more educated adults, and they use the degree completion as the marker for that. But in fact, we are 1,000 points of light. We are not moving the dial. And my own view of that is that that resides in a local community where the key leaders across the spectrum decide that the Syracuse Public Schools and the Rochester Public Schools and the Albany and the New York City are going to do a more effective job of getting kids through the pipeline. And what we're learning is that philanthropy and investment is highly scattered. It's spray and pray. I like mentoring, so I'm going to fund this. I like after school, I'm going to fund that, without any regard to the evidence that the intervention is actually moving the dial. We're incredibly stuck. And I think we got there because we sort of thought that as a highly independent and diversified, lovely country, we didn't need the kind of policies that would incentivize the kind of community ownership of the problem that I think is required. And personally, because I am an educator, I've spent a lot of time in local communities getting a common table where all the leaders in the community say, we're going to crack this thing, we're going to do it by investing in a very focused set of interventions, and we're going to report to the public how we're doing, and that is a whole new game. And we probably can't legislate that federally as much as we've tried with Promise Neighborhoods and other interventions.
Wonderful. I would say, again, back to the IRL, as it was called?
ILR.
ILR.
Ron,
incredible.
Ron, sorry, I'm doing my best. I'm
I've done it twice now, Ron. I apologize.
That's all right.
But you all study, you know, governance models of how companies and how people organize themselves, and 13,174 government-run, highly unionized, highly politicized districts, school districts, is not the best governance model for this diverse group of students. And I would argue that the governance model in higher ed could politely, without like turning everybody's hair on fire, could probably use a healthy review as well. That the more we move to a student-centered kind of learning environment, where you have, you know, these higher expectations that exist in our great universities, you're going to get a better result. And I think that's possible, and I would argue that somehow we need to shift away from these systems and think of this as a lifelong learning environment as well, because what I've met a lot of people that, you know, on life's journey, it doesn't always go, you know, unless you're like an intact family, high income, where you got all the nurturing and all the protections that go on. Even there, you know, yep, life changes, but a lot of people in this country are one paycheck away from really bad things happening to them. And an education could help them, but they can't show up to a campus. They got to work. They got to take care of their families. And making the system more customized for them, I think, has to be a much higher aspiration for all of us.
You know, it's interesting. One of the many wonderful things that the chancellor has done is to move in that direction.
I know.
And I'll tell you, just permit me a political observation from a non-expert. We tend to agree across the political spectrum on the eventual goal of almost all these things. It's the pathway to get there that
That's
gets
right.
us hung up. So, but now we have about 12 minutes and 30 seconds because the college Republicans have given me a real serious script here to go down.
You would expect that from college Republicans. Serious, well-organized, thoughtful, compassionate.
Governor,
I for one am not surprised.
Governor, you are describing a Cornelian. I appreciate that. So we have about 10 minutes, 12 minutes that we can take questions from you all out there. We have mics being set up in the aisles, and I believe we have a mic upstairs right in the center. Is that correct?
I see it.
So please step up. I'll recognize you. And to the extent that you can make them very, very brief questions, we'll get more in. We do have about 10 minutes. Please.
Thank you for being here tonight. Proud Cornell alum, 2001 ILR school. Cornell is also one of the top feeders to AmeriCorps programs like Teach for America and City Year. And my question to all of you is, how do we get more people to actually stay in education as a career because of the statistics, Governor, that you talked about for student gains?
Well, you need to eliminate the protectionist systems that exist in many states. It boggles my mind that Teach for America teachers are not allowed to teach in some states. It just makes no sense at all. In Florida, we're the Baskin Robbins state. We'll take 34 flavors. We measure effectively. We have Teach for America. We have City Year. We'll take whatever we can to assure that children learn. So the first step is to actually tear down the walls that protect teachers based on collective bargaining. And secondly, I think there has to be a pay system and a reward beyond pay to keep kids in the classroom. I think Teach for America is actually doing a better job now of doing exactly what you're describing, of sustaining and making the learning experience longer. And the third thing that they're doing that's important in other organizations is that even if kids graduate to another profession, they stay involved in education in their communities, which is really important.
So what we're going to do to make sure we get more questions is just one of the panelists will answer each one, just to move it along. Please.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for being here. First and foremost, that was a great presentation. My name is Evelyn. I'm currently an MPA student here through the Cornell Institute of Public Affairs. And I actually am I have a Bachelor of Science here from Development Sociology as well. So one of the key problems that I see from someone who is going into education policy is that a lot of our kids become disenfranchised from the very beginning. And I think that part of the reason, or part of the issue in addressing higher education, is to go through primary and secondary education. That being said, I know personally I was tracked into a very, very low track. I was destined for failure from the beginning. My parents don't speak any English. They don't know how to read. They don't know how to write. I was not introduced to literacy in the beginning of my childhood, as most students that I come here with are. That being said, literacy to me is, it comes in a number of different forms. And one of the issues that I see in education is that we don't value different types of learning when it comes to our students. We don't value critical thinking. We value regurgitation. We value testing. Yes, it's important to benchmark. However, how can we include students who may not come from traditional paths? How can we include students who are not part of the mainstream? Do we teach Chicano literature? Do we teach African American history? Do we teach real African American literature in school as well? I would like to know your opinions when it comes to culturally relevant pedagogy.
Okay, let's give them a chance to answer.
Traditional education. Thanks.
I think there is a pretty substantive point of view, and I think we would all agree that we need a much more culturally and language sensitive curriculum. But I liked where you started. If we had all the time in the world, we would stop now and invest all of our funding in early childhood education. There is no part of the spectrum unequivocally scientifically concluding that early childhood education is the critical first step in all the things that you talked about. And let's not kid ourselves. We don't have a system of early childhood education. We have a lot of mom and pop places where aunts and uncles and families and houses. We don't have standards for what a quality early childhood program is, but we know unequivocally, if you don't have access to it, no matter what your cultural underpinnings, you will be behind the rest of the time. So I do think that in the policy level, the intervention at the earliest stage, I would probably say even prenatal, as many pediatricians would say, that's where the investment has to be, because right now, 40% of all children in America come to kindergarten not ready to succeed.
Before we go to the next question, I want to congratulate you on your journey so far. Way to go. There you go. Over here. Oh, I'm sorry. One up there. Up there, please. Up on top. Yeah, please.
Hi. Thank you very much for your presentation. Governor Bush, you mentioned how we want to have a child-centered education policy. One of the major barriers to that still is, especially in higher education, the cost. Each of you, the three of you on that stage, has tried in your respective areas to decrease the cost of higher education. To an unfortunate extent, it's still a major problem.
Huge.
I would like to know what the three of you think about the program that Oregon has tried to do or is trying to do. Their system that they've proposed is the state system, you can go to school all 4 years. If you do not want to pay, you don't have to. And then for a set period afterwards, for a set number of years, they tax your income so that you pay it back to them, so that the income is no longer a barrier for entry into that school. Now, Oregon or whatever state you want could set the year and the level. I think Oregon is 3 or 5% in 20 years.
Go ahead, Governor.
I'm just curious what the three of you think about that proposal.
So we'll just have the governor answer this.
I think it's a pretty cool idea. Another idea would be to take for students that have, you know, get into college with SAT levels at a certain amount and GPA levels, to give them free, have the state pay for their tuition, which in-state tuition at least, and that's what Florida does. The Bright Future scholarship program paid for by the lottery dollars lowers the cost of all-in cost of tuition significantly because of that state support. Prepaid scholarships is another means for both means tested as well as for middle class and upper higher income people to be able to give people a tool, a tax-free basis to invest in their kids' education and guarantee that the tuition is fixed. I like the idea that you're describing. It also could be done, by the way, it's being looked at by private people investing in students' future by taking a percentage of their future income and paying for their education as well. Now, that would probably require a relevant degree. I'm guessing that would have to have a degree that would generate income on a relatively quick basis. But we should try all sorts of things to deal with this.
We have time for two more quick questions, one there and then one here. Please.
Governor Bush, one of the primary tenets of your education reform in Florida was increasing school choice through voucher programs, charter schools, and things of that nature. How would you respond to criticisms that offering more school choice actually undermines the funding and the effectiveness of traditional public schools?
I would argue that the funding should go to the child, not to the system. You kind of got my views on the system. I don't think it's the role of the state or of society to pay for systems. It's to fund students. We should move to a student-centered system. And in fact, what we found, we actually do have the ability to follow students pre-K all the way through postgraduate in Florida. The former nerdy governor demanded that we have a database that did that. What we found is that student learning improved in the traditional schools. The more we expanded choices, the pressure on the system, particularly in the low-performing schools, they improved. And it's just a simple fact, if you think about it, if there's an alternative, there's a consequence to mediocrity, people respond. And so all schools got better because we had both public and private school choice.
And our colleague here for the last question, please.
So my question's for the governor. You mentioned earlier the need to stand up to teachers' unions. What do you think of the anti-union policies of Governors Chris Christie and Scott Walker, who are pretty much the face for that?
What are we doing? I'm not sure what that means when you go like this, but does that mean I'm being videoed?
Yeah.
Great. And I would say that the focus on, in the case of Scott Walker, of making Wisconsin a right-to-work state for public employees was a spectacular idea that improved the competitive position of Wisconsin for years to come. One of the challenges that existed. The unions actually have a health insurance plan in Wisconsin. And as such, because they required it as part of their collective bargaining process, they said that you had to use our insurance system. When they changed the system and allowed districts to negotiate their health care independently of the collective bargaining process, many of these districts had 40% reductions in health care costs with the same level of benefits. And that money then goes back into the classroom with higher pay for teachers. This was a good result for Wisconsin, and Christie's efforts have not yielded the same kind of results, but I like the guy's spunk. I think it's fantastic. I think he's trying hard, and he deserves high praise for taking on a system that is not going to be sustainable. 10 years from now, New Jersey is going to have a crisis in their pensions that is going to be of epic proportions unless they change. And so Chris's, belief is, deal with me now, or deal with a huge crisis 10 years from now where you don't have the benefits that you think you have. And that's what's happening all across by big city mayors, Democrats mostly, and by governors all across the country. And it ought to be done in Washington, D.C. as well, because we have these long-term structural problems as well.
And now we're going to... We're now going to turn this over for closing to Jessica Reif from the Cornell College Republicans. I just want to quickly say my thank you to the audience and the speakers.
On behalf of the Cornell Republicans and all of our co-sponsors, thank you so much for joining us for tonight's presentation. This was a conversation not of partisan differences, but one of collaboration and solutions. The question posed before the program was, what do we do now? What is next for education in America? The answer to this question is of the utmost importance for the future of our university and for the future of America. I thank you once again for joining us, and please give a round of applause for tonight's panelists, Governor Jeb Bush, President David Skorton, and SUNY Chancellor Nancy Zimpler.